Coming up, Pam Colleen gives us common sense solutions for our number one health problem.
It's the Livin' La Vida Low Carb Show with Jimmy Moore. And now, here's Jimmy.
Hey, and welcome back to the Livin' La Vida Low Carb Show with Jimmy Moore, episode 435. Today we have with us the author of a book entitled Addiction, The Hidden Epidemic. Her name is Pam Colleen, and she is here to tell us all about the various addictions that we have out there. Now, we often hear about alcohol addiction and drug addiction, but she talks about some other addictions that are out there that are just as strong and are causing just as much damage on our health as those ones that we hear about. And it's definitely going to be an interesting conversation today, so don't you dare miss a single moment. First, I wanted to remind you about a couple of our sponsors. One of them is Low Carb Survival Guide, and now here's a message from our sponsor. Today we have with us back again Adam Kozloff. He is the author of a brand new ebook you need to check out called The Low Carbers Survival Guide, Practical Wisdom for Living Low Carb in a High Carb World. Adam, welcome back.
Thanks, Jimmy. Glad to be back again.
Well, we heard you tell us a little bit about your book before, but you have two very exciting interviews that are exclusive to your book. Tell us about them.
Well, I am so blessed to have the chance to speak with Fred Hahn of Serious Strength, who's a fitness trainer out of New York City, and he developed the slow burn fitness approach to exercise, and his ideas about fitness and exercise are so revolutionary. I think they're as revolutionary as the low carb diet was to me.
Yeah.
I think everyone out there will really get a lot of that interview. And the second person is Gary Taubes himself, the author of Good Calories, Bad Calories, and the upcoming Why We Get Fat and What to Do About It. Spoke to me for a long time about topics that I think your listeners will find very, very interesting. It's a 45-page interview packed with really cool stuff about sort of like what to do when low carb fails. Why does anorexia occur? And all sorts of very interesting ideas.
Yeah. Now, you're the one who I interviewed on this podcast previously who basically took Gary's book, Good Calories, Bad Calories, and broke it down into little bite-sized chunks. Mm-hmm. On your website. So you kind of have a really good rapport with Gary. So I'm sure that that interview with him in your book is well worth it. Well, if people are very interested in getting a copy of the Low Carbers Survival Guide, we've made it real easy on you. It's lowcarbsurvivalguide.com. You go there, you get a very special introductory price just for listening to this podcast show. Adam was very gracious to offer this ebook, which is jam-packed. Now, how many pages is it?
I think it's 220-something.
And it's 220-something ebook pages, not the traditional little small mass-market paperback. This is a big ebook, and it really is power-packed with a lot of great information. Hope people check it out. Again, it's lowcarbsurvivalguide.com. And we want to share with you another sponsor today is Quest Bars. And here is a message from Quest Bars. Today we have with us Ron Kane once again from the Quest Bar Company. Welcome back, Ron.
Great to be here.
Well, today I wanted to talk about an ingredient in your Quest Bars that some people may go, huh? It's called chicory root fiber. What is that, and why is it so important to the Quest Bar?
Well, chicory root fiber is a naturally occurring polysaccharide. So essentially, it's a series of simple sugars that are grouped together in such a way that it acts as a fiber because your body can't digest the simple sugars.
Yeah.
And it's found in onions, garlic, chicory, leeks, and Jerusalem artichokes. That's where you get it from nature. And what they do, they basically pull that fiber out, and it creates a really interesting substance because it doesn't, it's really not digestible. And what we found is by using that in the bar, that's really one of the things that allows us to create a bar that doesn't use sugar or sugar alcohols, because if you look at every other bar on the market, they're going to have either or both of those.
Right. And it's sweet.
It is sweet. In fact, it's mildly sweet. It's not overpowering.
Right.
And, when we first got it, I actually sent it to a lab because I said, is this possible that this is a fiber that works like that? And it really does come back with it has almost no sugar. I mean, tiny micro percentages, and the rest truly is a fiber. So it's a really neat substance.
Well, and if people want to try that really neat substance, you still have the two free Quest Bars promotion going on. Go to questproteinbar.com/sample, and Ron has promised to get those out to all of my listeners just as quickly as possible so that you can try for yourself and see what all the fuss is about with these Quest Protein Bars. And now, without further delay, let's get into my interview with Pam Colleen. Welcome back to the Livin' La Vida Low Carb Show with Jimmy Moore. And today I am so pleased to welcome to the show the author of a book that you need to know about called Addiction, The Hidden Epidemic, Common Sense Solutions for Our Number One Health Problem. Her name is Pam Colleen, and she's the co-author of the New York Times best-selling book, The Great Bird Flu Hoax. Her book, her new book, as I just told you, is Addiction, the Hidden Epidemic. She has been independently studying nutrition and natural health for over 20 years, and her interest in nutrition and natural health stems from overcoming a very lengthy battle with chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia, and multiple chemical sensitivity. She's a dynamic and diverse public speaker, educator, consultant, and all-around good gal. Welcome to the show, Pam.
Thanks for having me on, Jimmy. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I'm real excited because, you know, a lot of people, they talk about specific kinds of addictions, but nobody's really tackled the whole totality of how addiction is a health problem and all of them working in concert with each other. And it's not just one. It's all of them that are really making people sick, quite frankly.
Right. We live in a highly addictive environment, and one thing I sought to do when I started doing research on the book was to find out if indeed we are more addicted today than any other time in the history of mankind. And although it's hard to really measure that, it really is the case that really we are more addicted today than ever before, and it's simply because of really a couple of very key variables. And one variable is that we have that many more things to become addicted to, and the second variable is that we are brain starved. We have really starved our nervous systems of the foods, of the nutrients that they need in order to run on properly. So we have this epidemic of depression and overall sort of bad mood problem, as what Julia Roth calls the bad mood epidemic.
Right.
You know, and so we have this issue where, you know, people feel lousy, and so to help them feel better, they gravitate to you know, something to help them stimulate the brain in a way that it needs to be stimulated, so that they feel normal again. And so really, you know, we have what's known as the perfect storm for this addiction epidemic.
Yeah, and I can't wait to get into the details about that in a moment, because you wrote a very thorough book. I'm looking at it now. It's almost 400 pages long, so you really packed a lot of information in there for people. But tell us a little bit about yourself, your backstory. I said in your bio that you overcame a lengthy battle with chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia, and multiple chemical sensitivities. That seems to be the way a lot of people get into the world of health. I lost a lot of weight, and so that kind of got me into it. But tell us your story about how these things motivated you to become not just, I guess, you know, for your own self of being able to overcome it, but help other people now to mm-hmm. overcome their addictions and health ailments.
Well, I think really what happened was when I had chronic fatigue and I was trying everything humanly possible to get well, you know, this battle went on for, you know, 12 years where I would experiment with different diets and take lots of supplements and go to different natural health practitioners and really didn't get very far. In fact, a lot of the advice I got made me a lot sicker. Mm. And we can talk about this later, but one of the things I did and I shouldn't have done in hindsight was I became a vegan, and that indeed made my chronic fatigue that much worse. Mm. But one of the reasons why I was drawn to write about addiction was because, really, you know, I grew up addicted to sugar, and you know, that would have really set me up to collapse and have developed things like chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia and multiple chemical sensitivities. And so what that did was, because I was on such a high sugar diet growing up as a child, it really threw off my biochemistry, my overall biochemical balance. And so that includes things like your blood sugar, your your thyroid, your adrenal, your, you know, neurotransmitters are involved, your heavy metals are an issue. And so what I did was, you know, I had to learn how to nourish my body back to wellness. And I really only understood that when I got on to following things like eating more pastured eggs and grass-fed meat and, you know, eventually got into doing raw dairy products and following the principles of Weston Price. And so when I started understanding the principles of the importance of animal foods, that's really what helped restore my biochemistry in many, many respects. And so it really doesn't differentiate much from somebody who's struggling with an addiction, because in addiction, as I point out in my book, is these people are struggling with biochemical imbalances, very severe and serious biochemical imbalances. And what is, I think, offers a lot of hope to people struggling with addiction and their families is that when individuals who struggle with addiction go into the centers I describe in my book, and they actually measure their thyroid, measure their adrenals, measure their blood sugar, and so on and so forth, that they see on paper in black and white that there's something very physically wrong with them. Mm. And it's very similar to what I would have gone through with chronic fatigue. And, you know, if you know anybody who's abstaining from things like alcohol or drugs, you'll find that they, because they haven't restored their biochemistry in total, that they're still struggling with things like fatigue, depression, sleep disorders, and so on. And they really haven't, they may be abstaining from drugs and alcohol, but they're still not well. And I believe in my heart that these people do deserve to be well, and then they can be well, as long as they understand some of the principles I have in my book.
Now, you mentioned something in there about being a huge sugar addict, and I'm sure most Americans at some point in their life that got to be obese or got to be some kind of health issue in their life had an addiction to sugar. Pam, tell us why sugar gets such a free pass when it comes to addictions. We recognize cigarettes, we recognize drugs and alcohol, we recognize all of these things that people say are bad because they're addicting, and yet how many people walk around and say, besides people in like you and me in our circle, sugar is addictive? No, they're eating it like there's no tomorrow.
Yeah, well, it is. I mean, the first clue is that it's a fine white powder. I mean, that should tell everybody right there that it should be something you really need to approach with a lot of caution, if at all. I mean, if you can avoid it, all the power to you. But sugar is a highly addictive substance, and it alters brain chemistry and you know, makes you want to go back for more. So it has a very physical draw to it, and unfortunately, it's been painted as a fairly benign substance, and it's really not that benign. In fact, it can lead, because of the sugar addiction in and of itself, it can lead to, throwing off your biochemistry and then therefore putting you into the boat where you're leading to more addictions. And, of course, I talk in my book about caffeine addiction as well. And these two, the combination of these two substances, I mean, my goodness, it's really, really devastating people, you know, in the Western world in particular, because we're eating and consuming so much coffee and so much sugar that it's really, you know, predisposing us to feeling lousy, because these substances will potentially trigger things like depression and anxiety because they're overstimulating the adrenal glands. And then from there, of course, you could develop a gamut of other addictions that are even worse. And so it's really, again, ties into this perfect storm that we're in right now, where, you know, we have this vulnerability, and it's really creating this environment for us to be drawn to more addictions, both you know, substance abuse and activity type addictions.
You know, I never thought about that before, Pam, because we always hear, oh, marijuana is a gateway drug to harder cocaine and things like that, but sugar is a gateway to other addictions. I never really put two and two together, but that makes total sense.
Yeah, it does. And, you know, I think, I don't know if you've had Nancy Appleton on your show, you know, her recent book is, yeah, she's wonderful. I mean, she's been warning people for years about the problems. Kathleen Desmaisons, who wrote Potatoes Not Prozac, again, warning people about the effect of sugar on your neurotransmitters in the brain and, depleting these feel-good neurotransmitters that we have that help us develop our thought patterns and our self-esteem and things like that. And when she talks very clearly in her book that when she was a sugar addict, it really affected her self-esteem. And it's very common when you see people who are sugar addicts that they tend to have very low self-esteem. And it's not that they don't deserve to have self-esteem and they can't develop self-esteem. They can, but they have to get their biochemistry in balance before that can really happen.
Mm. Now, I recently had a vegan, I guess he's like the king of vegans, Dr. Neil Barnard, on my show. And during that interview, he said something that I couldn't help but laugh when I heard him say it, because I'm like, that's not really an addiction. He said that people need to overcome their meat addiction. And I know where he was coming from being a vegan, but why is meat not an addiction, or can it be an addiction?
No, I can't see it as being an addiction at all. I mean, all of us, we were all hunter-gatherers. And when I do classes, I go back into the history of food, and I go back thousands of years. And when you see the, invention of agriculture about 10,000 years ago, that's when you start to see physical degeneration in human beings.
Yeah.
So what happened was, is that when we were hunter-gatherers, our diets would have been heavy in terms of the content of animal fat, animal protein, and very small amounts of plant-based foods. I mean, we didn't have greenhouses during the last ice age. I mean, my goodness, we didn't have refrigerated trains until 1864. We didn't have refrigerated trucks until the 1940s. So we could not have, it's just not realistic for us to have been able to sustain ourselves on fruits and vegetables and sprouts. So, you know, we would have eaten a lot of animal fat, animal protein, you know, during the vast majority of the time that we were evolving. And then when we invented agriculture, of course, what ended up happening was, is we actually shrunk 6 inches. Our brain size also shrunk. Our lifespan went from about 26 years to 19 years, so our lifespan decreased. And also, they've discovered that at that time period when we invented agriculture is also when you start to see the rise of things like anemia, osteoporosis, and infectious diseases. So really, you know, when we started increasing our consumption of plant-based foods, that's when you start to see the problems, many of the physical problems that we're still seeing today, except now, of course, they're that much more exaggerated.
Oh, but Pam, don't you know that you get all these micronutrients from plant materials, and you have to eat those in your diet? It's the basis of a healthy diet. Don't you know that? I mean, isn't that like a natural? Everybody knows that plants and vegetables and fruits are all good for you.
Oh, my goodness, and all that sugar that comes along with it. I mean, no, absolutely not. We're fat burners. We're not sugar burners. And, we really need to start breaking that myth. And the whole agenda is, and has been for a long, long time now, is to turn us into vegetarians, because plant-based foods are easier to produce, easier to ship, have better shelf life, and they are more profitable than animal foods. So, you know, if you're running a grocery store, if you're, you know, running a World Bank, I mean, what do you want to subsidize? What do you want to push on people's tables? Is you want to push more plant-based foods. And so you see the consequence of that in these four food groups that we have that, you know, in all of their infinite wisdom, the USDA is pushing and so on and so forth. So, you know, I have a friend, unfortunately, she passed away, Dr. Louise Light, and she wrote a book called What to Eat. She was just a wonderful, wonderful human being. And when she worked for the USDA, and she worked on the 1992 food pyramid, she said, and with her staff, to the Secretary of Agriculture at the time, and this was after they had determined that, you know, there were supposed to be 6 to 11 servings of grains and 5 to 10 servings of fruits and vegetables
right.
on the food pyramid. And Dr. Light said to the Secretary of Agriculture, you can't do this. If you do this, you are going to create a diabetes and obesity epidemic. And so there was nothing in the science, nothing in the literature that supported that. But unfortunately, the Secretary of Agriculture caved to the lobbyists. And so that's what we still see today. But, you know, the writing was on the wall back in 1992, even before then. I have food guides back in First World War, Second World War, and it shows this progression to pushing us more on this plant-based food diet. And it's totally illogical. I know you've had Gary Taubes on your show, and in his book, he's very clear. When in the early 1900s there was all this immigration going on in the United States, they didn't have enough meat to feed all these new immigrants. So essentially what they did, they started using wheat over meat. I mean, I say that figuratively, but also in a sense literally as well. They just started making people full on breads. And then you fast forward, of course, to the Second World War. And then you start to see that after the Second World War, the rise of the processed foods that are on the shelves today. And none of that would have been possible without, you know, a lot of subsidies going into a lot of these foods, like, you know, wheat and corn and so on.
Right.
It's just been a disaster, even, you know, starting 10,000 years ago and even more recently in the 1950s.
So, Pam, how do we turn the ship around? I mean, it seems like Pandora's box has been open a while, and it's hard to get it all back in the box again.
Yes, it is. But you know what? We can be really grateful to you, Jimmy, for your radio show. I mean, really, this is an important forum for people to come to in order to learn about what really is essential to our health. And, you know, for me, in some respects, I'm grateful that I was a vegan because it made me appreciate the importance of animal foods. Had I not gone through that absolute nightmare, you know, where it just kept making me more and more tired, you know, and more sleep problems because I had depleted my nervous system of these very, very crucial nutrients that I try and point out in my book, you know, that I have a great respect now for animal foods, especially when these animals are properly raised on, you know, pasture and so on, and they're locally produced. And that's another whole side to the story. But, you know, I did try to do that in my book where I said, what are these nutrients that are in animal foods that are supporting our nervous system? And I think you took a look at the book, so you've seen some of the tables and so on that I have in there.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of people are supplementing with these nutrients. And that might be all well and good, you know, for helping to catch up a little bit. But in an ideal world, Jimmy, what we're supposed to be doing is eating 3 square meals. And we're not doing that anymore. So it's very, very simple. But what gets in the way is all this clutter. And it's the clutter that I believe is really making us sick.
Mm.
And that's misinformation, propaganda, you know, this greed, it's incompetence. You know?
I think you hit it with incompetence. That seems to be kind of the biggie these days. Now you mentioned, Pam, that you were a vegan, and you told me in an email that you're a quote-unquote recovering vegan, in fact, a raw food vegan, and you told me a really cool story. I want you to tell us a little bit about how you got out of veganism and this story about how you've done radio shows and vegans contacting you and what happened.
Well, what ends up happening is when I do radio shows, very commonly I'll get responses from vegans who thank me and say, oh, you know, I helped them realize that there was a connection between why they felt so lousy and the vegan diet. Because as a recovering vegan myself, of course, you know, the whole time you're on the diet, you don't think it's the diet because they keep telling you it's such a healthy diet. So there's this huge disconnect going on. And then when I go on the radio and I expound on it a little bit more, then I get responses. And a couple of responses I got recently, one was from a woman in Mexico who runs a raw food vegan restaurant. And she told me that she was running out to get some fish. And another woman in Florida wrote me and said, you know, she too ran a raw food vegan restaurant, and she was running out to get some buffalo after she heard me on the radio. So... So it's really about giving them permission, you know, to be able to connect the dots. And I think, you know, you've had Lior Keith on your show and her new book, The Vegetarian Myth, a wonderful book. You know, she too helps, I think, liberate a lot of vegans from that disastrous diet. And it really is. It's what it is. I can't say it in any other words. It's a disastrous diet for health, for fertility, for mental well-being, and so on.
So what is the worst part of a vegan diet? What, you know, if people come up to you and they say, okay, just give me the Cliff Note nutshell, what is the absolute worst part of a vegan diet? What do you say?
Well, their argument is that it's more sustainable. But what I often say is, how can it be sustainable when it's going to reduce your fertility or cause you to be infertile?
Mm.
How can that be sustainable if it's that good a diet? Then, you know, show me cultures where people have been on a vegan diet for generations. And of course, they can't do that because there are no cultures anywhere in the world that have lived for generations on a totally vegan culture. So, you know, it's not sustainable to the human race. And that's probably the most powerful point I try to drive home, simply because that's not something that they tell you in a vegan, in their vegan propaganda. They don't tell you that it will decrease your fertility. I mean, I can't tell you the ex-girlfriends that I've met, you know, of ex-boyfriends who were vegan, and they totally didn't have any libido, so they were never interested in having sex. Now, so then these girls say, now I understand why, you know?
Yeah. Now, that's interesting, because one of the selling points of the vegan diet is, oh, well, you'll get your mojo back. And I've seen that in some ads, and I've heard, of course, Dr. Barnard said that in my interview with him. Why is there such a disconnect there? It seems like there's two opposites happening.
It's probably just wishful thinking. I mean, I've been at this for over 20 years, and I've traveled and pounded the pavement for a long time, and I've lost count of the people who I've spoken with, and you know, given me testimonials on the fact that they have lost their libido, or they had to go for fertility treatments in order to get pregnant, or they've had problems. I have a couple of clients that were vegan when they were pregnant, and their children are still not totally recovered. They're still having learning disabilities. It's heart-wrenching when I hear the stories, and I think it's just really unethical for them to try and suggest that this diet is supporting your sex hormones, when really your sex hormones can't work properly without adequate amounts of cholesterol, dietary cholesterol, and things like vitamin A, the retinol, the preformed vitamin A that you would get from things like eggs and butter and meat and liver and so on and so forth. So it's just a physiological fact that you need these nutrients to support your sex hormones. Mm-hmm. And what are we seeing because we're on this low-fat, frenzied diet? And I'm not even talking here about vegans and vegetarians. I'm talking about people just following a low-fat diet. What are we seeing? I mean, 10 years ago, if I were driving through Washington or Chicago, I wouldn't have heard ads on the radio about, you know, advertising fertility clinics. Today, when I drive through big cities, what do I hear? Almost every second or third advertisement is for a fertility clinic.
Yeah.
I mean, and this is the low-fat consequence, and I call it the multi-trillion-dollar lie. You know, we need these fats to support our nervous system. There's absolutely no question about it.
Mm. Yeah, that hits home, because my wife and I can't have kids, and for many years we would drink the skim milk and 2% and eat low-fat because we were told that was healthy, and I guess, you know, that catches up to you if you eat that way, and unbeknownst to you, even though you think you're doing everything right, mm-hmm. you could still be causing damage to yourself. So that's why education is so key in this.
Well, now, the key thing is the situation can turn around when you go back onto animal fat. So there is a lot of hope in that as well. So
right. Well, let's get into the nitty-gritty of some of the concepts in your book, Addiction, The Hidden Epidemic, Common Sense Solutions for Our Number One Health Problem. And in Chapter 2, you just dive right into it. I love it. You go for the jugular right away with the rise of the pro-addiction diet. And in that chapter, you talk about how food companies, big food, deceives us into thinking that we're having something healthy when it's really just the opposite. And my wife and I did a series on YouTube last year called Health Claims Gone Wild, where we go through the grocery store and we see all these claims that are on the front packaging of food products. And it's like, really? That's supposed to make it healthy? You know, the things like the Fruity Pebbles said, a good source of vitamin D, and you look, it's got 100 IU of vitamin D, so that makes it a good source of vitamin D.
These companies are desperate. I mean, they know, though, the bottom line is that the more claims that they make on a package label, the more likely a consumer is going to buy it. Yeah. What I tell consumers in a nutshell is, if there's a label on the food, you probably don't want to buy it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just as simple if you want to just encapsulate it into one phrase. But, you know, they've known this for decades, you know, that these claims and having professional-looking organizations stand behind a product – make it so that the consumer feels safe, feels protected, feels educated, when indeed all they're doing is just putting out information, you know, that really doesn't have a lot of basis to it. The only way to determine whether something is truly healthy is to look at a culture, and this is the work of Dr. Weston A. Price, of course, mm-hmm. and then what you do is you look at that culture and you say, you know, are the couples fertile? Are the babies healthy? Do you see signs of chronic degenerative diseases? Do you see signs of mental illness? Are they aging gracefully? And you look at those parameters and you consider those parameters and then look at their diet and then, you know, try and respect that diet as much as you can. And when you hear things like, you know, eat lots of blueberries because blueberries are going to help you with your vision. Well, I have nothing against blueberries. I think blueberries are a terrific food. You just don't want to eat too many of them because of the sugar content, as you well know, right, Jimmy?
Right.
So, but you can't just have a standalone food like that and rely on that food for good vision. Because what else do you need for good vision? You need vitamin A, you know, the things that you would get from things like, you know, cod liver oil. So, you know, it's amazing how much they've been able to use even nutritional science to keep us really confused. And, you know, as I teach a class on the corruption in science, and I'm all about good science, evidence-based science. I think Gary Taubes, who's been on your show as well, he's a critic, but he's also all for evidence-based science. But unfortunately today, what we're not getting enough of this evidence-based science. What we're getting is marketing-based science, and that's not very healthy.
Well, and that just totally describes the USDA dietary guidelines. It's all marketing-based.
Yes.
It really has nothing to do with the science, because if they were paying any attention to the science, fam, they would know that some of the recommendations they're making is just ludicrous in light of what the science is telling us.
That's right. And you know, this is the devolution of science. I have a lot of friends who are very elite scientists, and they're retired so that they voice their opinion. They're not being censored. And, you know, one of them is Dr. Arpad Pushtai, who was the one who basically exposed the problems with the genetically engineered potato. And he has an article online called The Prostitution of Science. He calls it prostitution. There's, I mean, it's as blunt as that, and that's coming from a gentleman who's a very elite scientist. So we have to be very careful.
And the unintended consequence of that, Pam, is people begin to not trust any of the science that comes out because of the perversion that happens nowadays with the science that does come out.
That's right, and I think that's why I use the word common sense in my title, because
right.
on the one hand, I do respect good science. On the other hand, I think we need to marry it with common sense. And that's why I love the work of Dr. Weston A. Price, is because when you observe healthy cultures, you want to know, well, what are they doing right? What are they doing? And let's take a look at their lifestyle. Let's take a look what they're eating. And then let's see if we can mimic that as closely as we can if we want to achieve those same goals. And so that's, I think, my big message when I teach seminars, is to let people, give people permission to use their common sense.
I love in chapter 2 where you talk about how cheap food equals expensive health care, because one of the complaints that people have about having grass-fed beef or bison or any of the really healthy foods that you're advocating is, well, Pam, that's all good and everything for you because you probably can afford it, but I can't afford to buy those things because they're just too expensive for my budget. You know, and trying to explain, but look, down the road, you're going to have health issues if you don't eat good now. People live in the here and now. They don't think tomorrow.
Right. And you know, you're dealing with some people who have basic limitations over where they're going to get grass-fed or pastured animal foods. And for me, it is a priority, you know, but I don't get neurotic about it. I don't expect anybody to be, you know, obsessive compulsive about this and to let it rule their lives. You know, I think my big message to audiences is, as I say, you do the best you can with what you have. And, you know, some people, they may have to take a bus, you know, every day in, day out to get to work, to go to do their grocery shopping. And en route, there may not be any pastured animal foods. They may not have the time to go out and find them. So I just tell people, do the best you can. And if you go to the grocery store, do the best you can to stay on the outer periphery of that grocery store and avoid those dreaded middle aisles.
Yeah. Yeah. I interviewed a lady who is a paleo eater, and she lives in New York City. Melissa McEwen is her name recently, and she was talking about how she goes and gets her grass-fed beef. She doesn't make a lot of money. I think she said she made $14,000 last year, and she eats grass-fed beef. And I'm like, how do you afford grass-fed beef, $14,000 income, and in New York City, of all places? And she was like, well, I barter with the farmer. So a lot of the farmers will work with you if you find a good farm. I've got a farm about 10, 12 miles from my house where I get grass-fed beef. You know, they'll work with you. They'll make sure that you get what you need.
And it's worth every penny. There's no question about it. Not just with regards to your health, but with regards to the environment and supporting a local economy and so many other benefits to it. But many times, I mean, I know people who are millionaires who will not spend a penny more than they have to on meat, for example.
Wow.
So, you know, they just have certain, you know, stigmas attached to the foods, and so they just want cheap, and that's what they're going to get if they buy, you know, commercial meats, and that's their choice, and that's, you know, we have to respect that. But there are other people where, you know, they just simply can't find grass-fed. They haven't got access to it, and it's not my goal to scare them off of eating commercial animal foods, because
right.
Well, then what are they going to eat? They're going to eat maybe soy, and we don't want that.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the fear mongering I warn people about. In fact, I did a seminar once, and there was a woman in the room who was on a limited budget and had a couple of children, and she works at a local health food store, and everybody in the health food store, the vast majority of the people in this health food store are vegetarians or vegans. And so what they did was they scared her off of feeding her children commercial animal foods.
Wow.
And her children developed learning disabilities, and you know, she couldn't figure out what was going on. And when she came to my seminar, she jumped out of her chair, you know, applauding and saying, thank you, thank you, thank you, because I gave her permission. The only way she could afford to feed her children, in her mind anyway, was to buy the commercial animal foods. And I basically said, I gave her permission to do that. You know, and I hope her children are fine today, but at any rate, it's just this fear-mongering that goes on where, yes, in an ideal world, the gold standard is to buy from a local farmer and go and inspect that farm and make sure those animals are outside. That's the gold standard, but it's not necessarily attainable for everybody.
Mm. So what about fat? We often hear people say, well, of course you can get addicted to carbohydrates and sugar, but what about fat? Is fat an addictive substance?
Fat, actually, if you look at the word saturated fat,
right.
Look at it carefully. You think satiety, sated, satisfy. It satisfies you. So without those animal fats, it's very, very hard to control your blood sugar. And in my book, I have reference to a book I have from the 1940s, before the fear mongering came up in the, you know, after the Second World War.
Mm-hmm.
That doctors back even in the early 40s knew to stabilize blood sugar, you would put people on a diet high in animal fat and with lower amounts of carbohydrates. So it's very, very stabilizing to eat adequate amounts of animal fats in your diet, and that indeed will stabilize your mood.
And you talk all about that in Chapter 3 of your book. And we already hit on Chapter 4, where you talk about some of the nutritional deficiencies with the nervous system. The only thing I'll hit on is vitamin D on page 100, where you talk about that. It's interesting. Vitamin D has become this kind of superstar in the supplement world now, because everybody says, well, if you have a health ailment, it's got to be vitamin D deficiency, which, you know,
I know.
I mean, there are a lot of things that vitamin D can help with, and some of the mood issues, the depression, and even some of the addictive you know, nature of how people respond to various stimuli could be tied to vitamin D, right?
Well, exactly. And the problem with vitamin D, of course, is very difficult to get enough vitamin D in the diet and or from the sun. In an ideal world, of course, we would be getting adequate amounts of vitamin D by basking out in the sun. And unfortunately, that's not very reachable for most of us. And in foods, of course, unless you know which foods you're getting that have a high amount of relatively high amount of vitamin D in it, it's very difficult to get enough vitamin D from most of the foods that we eat today, the very common foods that we eat today. So I do see a place before supplementing. You know, I'm a big fan of things like cod liver oil. Mm-hmm. But I also, even myself personally, I do take extra vitamin D and try and get that 4,000 international units in every day.
Oh, so you do 4,000 IU. I got you.
Yeah, 4,000 is based on the recommendations of Dr. Veith, who is basically, you know, one of the world's foremost experts on vitamin D, and he happens to live here in Canada. I actually live in Canada. So he's out of Toronto, and that's what he recommends. And it seems to be, you know, touted by many other vitamin D researchers out there today.
Yeah, my wife and I both take 10,000 IU a day. And for my wife, Christine, it was a really big thing for her because she was taking Paxil for, was it depression and panic attacks and things like that. And within a year of taking 10,000 daily IU of vitamin D, she came completely off of the Paxil. And we come to find out she raised her vitamin D blood serum levels from 9, which is atrociously low.
Wow.
No wonder she was having to take a drug or whatever to try to help. But she got it up to 54, I believe was the number, and she doesn't take it anymore. And my pocketbook says, thank you so much.
Yes.
That was an expensive drug. I think
Vitamin D is very inexpensive. Yeah.
Oh yeah, vitamin D was like $8 for a big bottle of it from Sam's, and we were paying $175 a month for that Paxil.
Look at the side effects of that drug. It's crazy.
And she would go through the withdrawals if she didn't have it. And it was like, this is not right. She is totally addicted to that Paxil, and it was hard for her for a few months there, but. Pam, she overcame it. She got
better. Oh,
that's
great. Yeah, well, she's fortunate to have you in her life and to know about these foods. Absolutely, yeah. Oh, you're a blessing for everybody.
Well, thank you. Let's talk about Chapter 5, The Secrets of quote-unquote Happy Chemistry. What are some things that people can do? We kind of hit on the vitamin D a little bit, but what are some other things that people can do to help lessen the impact of, I guess, addictive properties of things that come into their life?
Well, I think one key thing that we need to do more of and we're not getting enough of is to sleep, and it's high-quality sleep. Mm. Because, unfortunately, what we've done is we've really put a lot of stress on our adrenal glands today. And because we're either overproducing our stress hormones, which generate from the adrenal glands, or underproducing our stress hormones because the adrenal glands have been so stressed for so long, it really can interfere with high-quality sleep and restful sleep, or what you might want to call restorative sleep. And so, you know, getting enough sleep is crucial. Getting enough rest, prayer, meditation, all of these things are very crucial. And everybody's got something that they like to do, whether it's that they may want to take up a meditation class, or they may want to take up Tai Chi or Qigong, or they may want to do yoga or Pilates. But anything that helps you relax, that's one thing that we absolutely need to do, and that will help rest the adrenal glands, and in turn help basically the rest of the nervous system as well. And there's a domino effect that will take place to help balance out that very imbalanced area of our body. And I will say, though, I do only touch on exercise. And the reason for that is because it opens up a whole can of worms. When I work with people, I ask them to stop doing, especially when they have, by the way, you know, chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia, depression, things like that. I ask them to stop doing aerobic exercise until they get stronger. They have to use that period of their lives in order to help heal the adrenal glands. And essentially what I tell people is, imagine that your adrenal glands are in a cast right now. We are going to heal those adrenal glands, and we don't want to overstimulate them while you're going through this healing phase. And so that's what they're going to do. They're going to do things like yoga and stretching or Pilates or something else other than getting their heart rate up. And then when they're feeling better, they can venture out and do more things. But just temporarily, I ask them to just take it easy. And I go to the gym and I, you know, may do some weights and stretching, but I really right now very carefully do exercise. I play tennis. you know, I stay active, but I don't push myself any longer. And that was another big mistake I made when I had chronic fatigue, was I over-exercised, and it actually depleted my adrenal glands even more. But I didn't know that back in the 90s, and now that I understand that, you know, I try and share that with the people that I work with.
But again, it's like the low-fat thing. We've always been told that's what you need to do to be healthy, and so people will beat themselves up. In fact, I was hearing something on a television program the other day, and it's like they were saying this person had lost weight, and it's like, oh, yeah, he did it the good old-fashioned way. He cut his fat, and he increased his exercise. Isn't that healthy? And I'm like, no, it's not.
Oh, no, it's not at all. You know, I have somebody I know who has very poor sleep at night, and what works for her is before she goes to bed, she eats some chicken skin, and it helps her relax and helps her fall asleep. That's what works for her. But again, what's in that chicken fat? You're going to get, you know, the vitamins and the nutrients that you need to help relax, things like your cortisol, your dopamine, you know, to help bring down the stimulating chemicals in your body in order to allow you to sleep. So that was always an interesting anecdotal story for me.
Well, definitely yoga and Pilates, if you ever do a class, oh, my gosh, you will sleep good at night. Trust me on that one. I do about 4 classes a week of those, and I love it. And it definitely helps you calm your body and be able to sleep better. And in turn, that helps you the next day and the next day and the next day, and it just kind of cascades on each other. Now, one of the things that's come up that people talk about is we must be having something in our system, in our food system, in the air. Something is making us prone to being more and more addicted today than ever before. Is that just a old wives' tale, or is there merit to it?
Oh, no, there's a lot of merit to it, but it's very difficult to measure it because there are just so many addictions out there. So in a nutshell, the way I concluded it in my book was that we just have that many more things to become addicted to, and so therefore we are indeed more addicted today than we ever have been in the history of mankind. But we're also more prone to developing addictions because we feel so lousy and because we're not sleeping very well, you know. So we're being drawn to substances that help calm or relax our nervous system, things like alcohol or things in during the day, stimulants that we may take during the day to help keep us awake, and that would be things like sugar and caffeine, and of course even worse, you know, things like, you know, cocaine or what have you. But there's also the problem with the prescription drugs, and really it's the prescription drugs that I talk about in my book and the problems that we're seeing with prescription drugs. And you know, even there was a documentary I saw online the other day about how it's such a huge problem in Florida that people are going all the way, you know, from Kentucky to Broward County in Florida to get their pain medications, because they're handing them out like candy down there. And in Florida alone, about 11 people are dying every day from taking these drugs and overdosing on these drugs. So we have a serious epidemic on our hands. And, you know, I think that people are certainly falling victim to these drugs because of they're just ubiquitous, and they're very easy to obtain. But they're highly addictive, and they're lethal as well. And so, you know, I talk about, and I'm not just picking on painkillers. I mean, there's, you know, all of the mood-altering drugs that are available through medical doctors. All these drugs are potentially addictive. And there's, you know, I think a couple hundred, even within the realm of psychiatry, that are available to us. And since we've been using these mood-altering drugs, we're no better off. We're still as mentally unstable today as we were when these drugs came to market. In fact, we're even worse off today than we were when these drugs came to market. And we have to look at other options.
What's really sad is all the children that are drugged these days. We have a girl across the street that comes over, and we take her to church with us, and she is on medication, and then she brings a friend who's on 3 medications. They're both like 14, 15 years old. They're taking medicines, and then I look at their diet, and it's sugar, 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 and I'm going, ugh!
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons.
Don't need to be on.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, ADHD is not a Ritalin deficiency.
Right.
There are some clear nutritional problems going on with these children. And, you know, just like depression is not a Prozac deficiency, we need to look deeper than just looking at the pills as the solution. And that's one of the reasons why I wrote this book, is really for the children, because one of the doctors in my book, Dr. Natasha Campbell McBride, I was listening to one of her seminars, and she said, you know, we're turning our children into addicts. And I just about fell out of my chair, and I said, she's right. And I just knew I had to write this book because, you know, right now, today, 20% of children during their childhood are going to be diagnosed at some point as having some sort of mental disorder. 20%, Jimmy.
Wow.
This is craziness. And you're right. Instead of feeding them three square meals a day, these kids, I mean, many of them don't even know how to use a knife and a fork. They only know how to eat out of a bag. And then you have, I talk about the video game addiction and how, you know, there's a lot of issues in and around that problem. But one of them is that they're so busy playing these games that they're not eating a regular meal.
Yeah. Yeah. That same family, they have a little boy who's 15, but he's a little bit mentally handicapped. But he will go and play video games for like 12 hours straight, and he won't go to the bathroom. He'll pee on himself. I mean, it's just really, it's amazing how something like a video game can be so addictive, and yet it's impressionable. And then the other thing that comes into play there is it's a violent video game, and so it makes it that much more addictive because he's got to have that stimuli. It makes me worry about when he becomes an adult, what he's going to do because of that addiction to the video games. How's he going to play that out now in life?
Yeah, and there are a lot of, that's a loaded statement, and I'd love to chat more about it, but in a nutshell, you touched on something there, and that is to talk about in the book the importance of the family meal, and that, you know, that may be a utopia, that may be difficult for many people to integrate into their daily lives, but there has been some research that has come out. There's a book about it called The Surprising, it's in my book, by Miriam Weinstein, I think is her name, The Surprising Power of the Family Meal, and it talks about how the more family meals that you have together during the week, the less likely your child will engage in risky behaviors, in a nutshell. So it doesn't have to happen three square meals of the day, but the more you can do that as a family, the more stabilizing it is for the children, of course.
Now, the other thing that happens in the 21st century, and it's not just children, I mean, 99% of what I do on a daily basis, Pam, is on the internet.
Yeah.
I mean, I have a blog, I have a podcast, I do YouTube videos, I surf around, do research. Can you become addicted to the internet, and how do you overcome that? How do you set those boundaries up to prevent that from happening?
Right, and I do have an interview in the book with Dr. David Greenfield, who wrote the book Virtual Addiction, and he said, you know, when he first got online back in the 90s that he was having some problems in his marriage because he really got, you know, a little overboard on his time on the internet. But it really, what he's saying in the book is, you know, the internet is a blessing and it's a curse, and I agree with him. I mean, I'm on the internet like you. I mean, I'm learning all the time from the internet. For me, it has been a blessing, but, you know, you really want to be able to set boundaries, and so that you have a normal life, that you have real-time activities going on above and beyond doing, you know, spending your time on the internet. And so that means engaging in sports or community activities, getting involved with community, you know, volunteer work, whatever it is that floats your boat, sort of thing. So, you know, it's a matter of balance, Jimmy. So certainly nobody is saying the internet is all bad, but, you know, we have to also, you know, have real-time activities, look at each other in the eye, you know, shake each other's hands, give each other a nice big hug. We have to have that interaction because that's part of being human.
I deliberately take breaks so that I can be with Christine and we go and do things. And so it's a little, you have to find that healthy mix so that you can both benefit from what the internet offers and yet not be pulled down and become addicted to it so that you can't live without it.
Yeah, and I think what happens is for many of the problems that I'm pointing out in my book today, that are in my book, especially in the second part of my book where I interview the therapist, is for many of the issues, unfortunately, they're being normalized and not being talked about. And so when I decided to do this book, oh boy, Pam, you're writing a book on addiction. You know, it's it's taboo. It's the elephant in the room. There's no solutions for it. You know, not one single person has told me that it's not a problem. Mm-hmm. Everybody agrees that we have a serious problem on our hands, and especially where it comes to our children.
Yeah.
And so that's why I decided to have a lot of resources in the book, like people like Dr. David Greenfield and Julia Ross is in my book and Charles Gant is in my book and all these places that people can go to look for help, to know that, you know, if you have the least amount of questioning going on with regards to certain behaviors that you may be seeing in a loved one, it's not your imagination. There really is a problem going on today, and we need to bring things back to balance if we expect to help, especially our next generation.
Well, and that leads to my final question for you today, Pam, and that is, we always hear about preventing other diseases. Let's prevent heart disease. Let's prevent cancer. Let's prevent obesity. But is there anything that's being done? Is there any kind of movement out there to help prevent addiction?
No. I mean, they want us to be addicted. I mean, that's the bottom line.
Even who's they?
They, the food companies, the drug dealers, the pharmaceutical industry, the food industry. You know, they want us addicted to their substances, to their foods, to their drinks. They want customers cradle to grave. And they want to secure that by making whatever it is they're selling addictive. So I'm the arch enemy in terms of writing this book and saying, you know, let's not be addicted. Let's find out ways where we can feel happiness, where we can feel joy, where we can sleep well at night, where we can feel motivated without having to rely on a drug. Why can't we do these things naturally? And, you know, there's the explorers that I've looked at, Dr. Weston A. Price and Sir Robert McCarrison, when they studied primitive cultures, they did have addictive substances in their tribes or villages. But what they noticed was is that the people never abused these substances. They used them, but they didn't abuse them. And so, man has been using mood-altering drugs since the dawn of civilization. We've been experimenting with them. I'm not being puritanical and saying, you know, we're never going to use these drugs or don't use these drugs. That's not going to get us anywhere. But why is it that we're abusing them so much today? And I think it's because, number one, they're much more concentrated than they ever have been in the history of mankind because of chemists and so on. We've been able to, even engineering plants to have higher levels of THC and all of these sorts of phenomena, that they're far more concentrated so that they're going to be potentially that much more addictive as well. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we have a serious issue, and then the pharmaceutical industry is right there, you know, touting the benefits of all their drugs. So we have to be very, very discerning, and we have to say, can I do this? Is there a way that I can do this without having to rely on an outside substance? Because, this is something that has become normalized, and even Aldous Huxley in his book Brave New World foreshadowed what it is that we're seeing today, where in his book you have this world, entire world of people that are taking Soma, this ubiquitous drug that made everybody in their society these mindless drones. Mm. And so, you know, today in the United States, about half of the American public is on at least one prescription medication, and it may not be a mood-altering drug, but there's a good chance that it might be.
Yeah.
So, you know, what else can we do? Because we've been using drugs for a very, very long time, but the problem has snowballed out of control today, and it's gone. And because of the pharmaceutical industry, it's gone from bad to worse, in that we've been able to avoid looking at real solutions to the problem. And that's what I address in the book. It's like, what are the real solutions? What are things that we can look at? And there's a group of therapists in my book from this alliance, and they have about an 80% success rate in curing addiction and mood disorders. And one of their main mantras is to get people on 3 square meals a day, especially when they're in rehab. Mm-hmm. And then they use very targeted amino acid supplements in order to help rebuild the neurotransmitters that have been depleted because of drug use or starvation or what have you. And they're just tremendous people. And I tell you, they're so busy, they can't keep up with the demand. Because in other regular rehabilitation centers, they have up to about a 90% failure rate. And what do they do? What do they say to their clients? They say, well, you know, relapse is part of recovery. Well, I just don't think that's good enough. I think these people deserve to get well. They deserve to have full lives. They deserve to, you know, keep their families together, to achieve their careers, their hopes, their dreams. And until we get to the grassroots part of the problem and deal with the real issue that's going on, which is biochemical imbalance, unfortunately, these people are going to continue to suffer. And addiction, substance abuse in and of itself, is our number one health problem. It's not cancer, it's not heart disease, and it's not diabetes. It's substance abuse. There are more deaths and disabilities due to substance abuse than from any other cause. And it's costing the U.S. economy over $500 billion every year. But because, again, it's the elephant in the room. Nobody's talking about it. And the solutions that are out there are not effective. So that's basically, in a nutshell, what I try to address in my book, is to try to find effective, common sense solutions to this very, very devastating problem that's hitting society today.
Her name is Pam Colleen. She is a health and wellness coach out of London, Ontario, Canada. You've been listening to her talk about her latest book, Addiction, the Hidden Epidemic, Common Sense Solutions for Our Number One Health Problem. I'll have a link to it in the show notes section at thelivinlowcarbshow.com/show notes. Well, Pam, thanks so much for joining us today here on the Livin' La Vida Low Carb Show and educating us on addiction, because quite frankly, we overlook these things and we put the focus on all those other issues like heart disease and cancer and obesity, and yet we forget there's an underlying issue, and usually it's connected in some shape, form, or fashion with an addiction. So thank you so much for your work.
Thank you so much for having me on, Jimmy, and you keep up the great work.
Coming up next time on the Livin' La Vida Low Carb Show, we've got anti-low carb blogger Carb Sane from the Carb Sanity blog.
Visit our website at thelivinlowcarbshow.com/show notes. And email us anytime at llvlcshow@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.